It's time for another exciting installment of the Stop Chasing Pain podcast with Dr. Perry Nicholson, where we'll talk with industry innovators and passionate game changers to help you do what you love better, learning and sharing information to change the world one podcast at a time. So get ready for the knowledge bombs and brain booms. StopChasingPain.com. Move smarter. Move better. Feel great. Here's your host, Dr. Perry.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Stop Chasing Pain podcast. I am your host, Dr. Perry. I have to tell you, I am so excited to bring you today's episode. I've been holding on to this guy for about a week with such excitement, and I've been working to get this particular individual on my show for a while, and we finally made it happen. I've got Dr. Zach Bush, medical doctor, on the show. On his Instagram channel, it says this: triple board certified physician applying the rigor of science, the strength of humanity, and the intelligence of nature to transform our world. First of all, how beautiful is that? But second of all, we had about an hour-long conversation that I have to say was transformational for me in many ways. What I love about Dr. Bush is that, yeah, he's brilliant and he's put his time in, but he really talks on a humanistic level, like really connects with the people that he teaches. And you might want to hold on to your heart, hold on to your soul, hold on to your brain on this one, and you'll want to listen to it several times, that I can assure you, because it's that powerful. So without further ado, I'm going to get into the show here, but I want you to make sure you check out StopChasingPain.com. That's my website, and you can take a look at all the courses and stuff that I offer all over the world to help people live a better quality life and take back control of their health. And it's with speaking with magnificent individuals like Dr. Bush that makes that possible. So let's rock and roll. One, two, three, here we go.
Hey, Dr. Zach, thank you so much for coming on to the Stop Chasing Pain podcast. It is a huge honor to have you on my show today.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. I'm so appreciative of your time and the audience here and the focus that we all have together as an exciting human moment.
Awesome. Well, folks that are listening, we have a lot to talk about. We're going to spend about an hour together. And the doc, we were just on the show a little bit discussing how much I followed his work, how much I love the work that he does, because it's actually made a huge transformation in my own life of the way that I look at the body, but also the way that I look at myself as a person and as a human and kind of my purpose and my life mission when I was recovering from my illness. And we just got to talking a little bit, and I told him, I said, I think this is going to be a great way to kick off this show. And, you know, Doc, I mean, we were talking about how we've got this perspective in healthcare today of disease management or going after these names of processes that people walk into. And it's almost like I sense that we're losing this perspective of who we are as human beings in relationship to all of these diseases and illnesses. So can you talk about what you were mentioning before about if disease process care as opposed to health and human care?
Yeah, I think that this is kind of a tipping point in human history right now where this advent of medical science that's kind of debuted in the last 150 years, where we start to look at disease processes and then study these disease processes far more in depth and with much more focus than we do at health. And this is a big departure from, you know, thousands of years of Chinese medicine, for example, or herbalism and things like that, where there was a real understanding that there was an intrinsic capacity and quality of health in the human body. And therapies were supposed to come alongside these intrinsic capacities for health and healing to support those. What we transitioned to starting in like the late 1800s was more of this model that, interestingly, I believe really started with the belief that there were bacteria and germs. At the time, we didn't really call them bacteria, but there was germs. And this germ theory was that we were under attack and we needed to fight back and battle back disease, and it was this. that kind of slippery slope of, you know, starting with things like tuberculosis and things like that, as we started to tease out between 1880 and 1920, the whole germ theory, the idea that surgeons should wash their hands between patients with gangrene and not gangrene and things like that, there was just this burgeoning understanding that maybe, you know, diseases could be controlled and prevented. It changed our mindset in the subtle but profound fashion of, if we study disease enough, we could beat it all back. And we stopped looking at health. We stopped believing or kind of understanding this intrinsic capacity for healing that the body obviously has. That then, of course, accelerated over the course of the mid-20th century. In the mid-20th century, we see the debut of things like antibiotics and penicillin coming out in the early 1940s. Penicillin was relegated to really only for the troops in World War II because there wasn't enough supply, production capacity wasn't able to get it out to the general public. So it was used kind of in an experimental way and for emergency surgeries and things like that to reduce infection risk during surgery during World War II. Post-World War II, we had fully kind of bought into this concept of germ warfare, if you will, that we need to kill the germs and we need to be sterile. And so this whole kind of realization that we should simply wash our hands between surgery patients turned into we should sterilize the whole operating room. We should sterilize ultimately the whole hospital. We should sterilize the patient. And so we got extreme in this kind of concept of, If we can just keep it all human, if we can beat back all the germs, then we can be disease-free. I think this was the beginning of the end of human health as we started to really believe that we should be this narcissistic kind of isolated entity and therefore protected and therefore healthy. And that's where we started to collapse. And of course, now all of you are this explosive information about the microbiome, and we're starting to understand that the microbiome is at the root of all of the diseases that are out there in the chronic disease kind of setting. And so we're starting to realize we really screwed things up about 80 years ago around our belief in what human health is based on. But in that 80 years, we also developed the belief that we also had to beat back cancer and we had to beat back the immune system with steroids and immunosuppressants and all of this. Like, we turned our attention to beating back the microbiome, to actually beating back our own physiology, which really at the 30,000 foot level is insane, right? Like, yeah. When did we as a medical science decide that we needed to kill the immune system or suppress the immune system to allow health to happen? When obviously the immune system is the beginning of this relationship between you and the outside world, and that healthy dynamic relationship would then help inform you on how you react to that environment. And ultimately, and this is where it gets fascinating and sneaks us into this kind of psycho-spiritual world, is what is your purpose within that environment? And that, I think, is super, super fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of great points in there. I mean, because there's two that I think of right away. Do you think we've gotten to a point where we're so obsessive about being clean that we're actually making our immune systems weaker because we're not getting dirty? We're not playing in dirt, right? Like you mentioned, like touching dirt and soil and growing your own food. I mean, that does a lot for your immune system, right? But every time you turn around, you've got antiseptic this and that.
Yeah, I think food is an interesting place to, you know, start the conversation. It's obviously where I spend a ton of my time, you know, thinking and all of that. But we can also look kind of beyond the food just to the sterilization of the environment. And since the 1970s, we've understood in the medical science and literature has played this out that the hygiene effect in populations has a negative effect on health. And it ultimately is most easily tracked in the immune system itself. And so as we increase hygiene, sterilizing or keeping away the microbiome from the human experience, we see rises of asthma was the first realization. But now we realize autoimmune diseases and the like are part and parcel to that. But immune dysfunction, asthma, respiratory sensitivity, gut sensitivity, as well as, you know, deeper immune system function starts to get screwed up when, as you say, we start to live away from the soil, away from the dirt, away from the microbial diversity that the planet had for us, in which we developed for, you know, 200,000 years. And so for 200,000 years, Homo sapiens are developing in this space of, you know, complex ecosystem, and we have a role within that ecosystem, and we're thriving there. And suddenly, late 1880s, we start to adopt the germ theory, and so we start to dump iodine and other compounds to try to kill stuff in the operating room and elsewhere. And so that then creeps into this new world whereby the advent of, you know, vaccines being a big, you know, stepping stone for what we think of as modern medicine. The vaccines were the idea of that if we could just train the immune system to eliminate this bacteria from our environment. And so something like smallpox or polio were those early targets. And so we thought if we could immunize people before they were exposed to these bacteria, then we would be able to mount an immune response such that that bacteria would never have a relationship with the human body. Interestingly, if you look at the rates of autoimmune disease since the advent of these mid-20th century vaccines and then every vaccine that's added after that, we see it ratcheting up of autoimmune disease. And so on the one hand, you say, well, that's correlation, not causation. But then we back up and say, well, it's got to be causation in the sense that the thing that informs the immune system on how to recognize self is its reaction to the outside world. And so the newborn baby has no innate immune system as far as its reactivity to the outside world. It doesn't make its own antibodies. It's relying on mom's antibody production through the breast milk. It has cellular immunity there, but not this kind of, innate immune system that's able to go out and produce antibodies and the like. And so in the first 6 months of life, we're very naive. What programs the kid between birth and 6 months is exposure to that outside world. And repeated exposure, the thymus is where we have that kind of very young immune system developing. It sits right behind the sternum of the infant. And that thymus is where we're starting to learn outside and inside world. And so this is where we're coding the immune system to understand what is human and what is internal healthy microbiome look like and what is outside world and potential pathogen or invasive species. And so that thymus is where we're doing all this inside-outside training. If in that 6 months that child only gets exposure to an air-conditioned house with drywall and plastic carpet and highly processed air-conditioned air, heated or otherwise, that child is going to see a very, very tiny subset of what nature would have provided that thymus. Mm. And so the training is very weak, if you will. And so in that first 6 months of life, if you're not outside, if you're not exposed to that ecosystem that we developed in for 200,000 years, the thymus is kind of clueless. That thymus isn't getting that kind of sense of, oh, wow, that's that huge outside world that I can collaborate with, and I need to, keep it in check. I don't want it taking my body over, but I'm going to learn that inside-outside experience. And so I think that first 6 months of life is one of the most important times for us to get our children out into the world. And yet that's the most likely time that we don't have them out in the world. We're afraid of germs. And so right. I just went to a newborn baby's house last week, and they're like, make sure you wash your hands before you touch the baby. Don't kiss the baby. It's not old enough yet, all this. I started my medical career in the Philippines, birthing babies. I thought I was going to be here. I was going to be a mechanical engineer and build robots. That's what was my passion. I thought that was so exciting. But then I, had the classic, heartbreak relationship at the end of high school. And being that dramatic, heartbroken 19-year-old kid, I was like, well, my life is devastated. I need to get my bearings back and right. get regrounded. And so I decided I was going to take a year off. And minutes after I decided I was going to take a year off and defer my enrollment in the engineering program, my aunt called and was like, hey, you want to come to the Philippines and work with my group of midwives? We could use some help. And I was like, I don't have any medical background, but that sounds super interesting. And so worked for 6 months in a tire shop, busting tires, make some money, and saved up enough money to go over, lived there for 6 months, worked with a group of international midwives. Delivering babies there, you literally are in the squats outside of Manila, Philippines. It's squalor. And, you know, there's just dirt everywhere. It's there is no indoor-outdoor environments. Everything is an outdoor environment. The tin shacks are just to keep the rain off your head when it's pouring monsoon rains on you. You're living in mud in half the year, and then you're living in just intense heat and dry climate the rest of the year. And so you just got this, you know, intense experience. The houses are, you know, nothing is air conditioned in the space. Everything is dirty, as we would consider it in kind of the modern medical standpoint. We would go in and we would deliver the babies in the women's bedrooms, usually on a small little cloth mattress that's on sitting on a dirt floor. And then that baby is immediately thrown onto the breast of the woman who hasn't showered because they simply have no showers. They do bucket baths and things like this. And so she's covered in microbiome and life. And that baby thrives in the end. That baby has a much lower risk of chronic disease than the American child would end up with. The rates of asthma, eczema, attention deficit, autism, all these so much lower in that child who's born in an ecosystem. Nobody's saying wash your hands before you touch the child. In fact, the child has passed around 15, you know, family members before you even get out of the house from delivering the baby. And so that child is being covered in that external environment from the moment it's born. And that seems to defer in a protective effect, not a risk on that child. And so we're really screwing things up from the moment we enter this world. The extremity to which we've gotten this is we start to vaccinate our children against the outside world on day one now. Ironically, that day one vaccine is hepatitis B, which is a sexually transmitted disease that child can't even mount an appropriate immune response to until they're 6 months of age. And so you're vaccinating a child without immune, capacity at that moment of childbirth. And what we see around 2012 implementing that is we quickly became number one in the world for death on day one. And so the United States is the most dangerous place to be one day old. Wow. You are more likely to die in the United States than any other developed country in the world. And so it's fascinating that our terror and fear of that, ecosystem through which we developed for 200,000 years is exactly what we probably most need. And it's that fear paradigm that sets us up for this chronic disease mechanism in our body.
Yeah, I mean, that's so many great points in that. And, one that really hit me with that one is of how this process starts for a human being as soon as they're born. And I know you're a triple certified medical professional, and you've studied a lot. What I found through my journey of recovering from my autoimmune disease and, trying to always manage it and dealing with everybody else is that I usually find an answer for what's going on with them when I have to go really far back in their history to look at what I call their life load from the beginning of how it all comes together. And I see, at least from a medicine standpoint, is that we're always looking for, what they're coming in with that day or what might have immediately preceded them getting sick. But I think we've lost the ability to go really far back to put the picture together of the human being in front of you. Do you find that as well?
100%. I think it's, the way in which my medical practice has changed is, back, 10 years ago, I was developing chemotherapy at the University of Virginia, very much steeped in the pharmaceutical, Western medical, allopathic model. And if I walked into clinic, my first question was, what is your chief complaint? My complaint is type 2 diabetes and high blood sugars. Okay, when did you get diagnosed with type 2 diabetes? 6 years ago. Okay, 6 years, and my brain's going, diabetes for 6 years, that on this trajectory of pathophysiology, I'm pretty sure that they've got fatty liver and they've got, some pancreatic amyloid deposition by this time. They probably have deficient capacity for producing insulin after years and years of overproducing insulin because of insulin. So that's the kind of crap that was going through my mind. Now I walk into clinic and my first question is, hey, how you doing? What's your name? And they tell me their name. And I'm paying attention to their name. And then I'm listening to that story of like, where were you born? Where'd you grow up? And how were you born? by C-section, by vaginal delivery? Were you the first child? Were you the fifth child? Was your mother 20 or was your mother 30? Was your mother exposed to antibiotics while you were in the birth canal because of prolonged labor, and she ended up in a C-section? That's where disease now starts in my mind. Disease is always a symptom of a lack of health. When does health begin? At the moment of conception, which means that you're really imprinting all of mom and dad's previous life on that moment of conception. So their epigenetic patterns that are now expressed in the sperm or in the egg are now going to come together. And as soon as that egg starts to divide, that new organism that's now protected from mother because of her progesterone and it's in this kind of holy of holy space within her body where her own immune system can't even see that organism now is not only carrying mom and dad's stress forward via the epigenetics, it's now experienced its own potential for either nutrient delivery and health or toxicity and stress. And so that organism during the 9 months is going to have some developmental opportunities to either express one body or another. The interesting thing, if you look at this world of our new understanding of epigenetics and more recently microRNA, which are the components of genetic information that are outspring from the 99% of our genome that doesn't express a gene. You know, most of the DNA in your body doesn't build a gene that will then go make a protein that will then make a body. Instead, 98.5% of that DNA is what we call junk DNA. Well, of course, there is no junk in nature, and it turns out that junk DNA is making these microRNA that are the communication network of the genome between cells. So epigenetics is the modification of on-off switches for genes, and then microRNA is kind of the more fine, the higher resolution control of which gene should make which outcome or which protein. We now know that a single gene can make over 200 different proteins given the information around it in microRNA or otherwise. 200 times your 20,000 genes, you start to realize you can make millions of different bodies at any given moment. And that's extremely interesting to me, that the genetic information that's passed on to that egg could build 4 million different bodies with or without disorders or disease of a vast variety. Wow. In the same way, we now know that that's a very plastic event, that your ability to build those 4 million different bodies doesn't stop at conception or at delivery. What you've done in your life, which is so fantastically interesting on a science way and so beautiful on a humanistic standpoint, is you built a different body. You had a body that was machine-made or was setting up the perfect chessboard for an autoimmune disease to happen. A lot has to get screwed up before your body starts to mistake itself for a disease process and attack itself with its own immune system. There has to be a lot of misarranged pieces on that chessboard. What you did subsequently was to build literally a different body. Same genes didn't change, but you built from that genetic information a different body that was going to react differently to your environment. And certainly you did that through some shift in your microbiome and the more complex ecosystem. But we know very clearly now at the science level, you literally changed the proteins that your body would make from your DNA. And you arranged those proteins in a different fashion such that you literally had a different body. Your gut membrane changed. Your neurochemistry and its relationship to that gut changed. Your ability to detox the body changed because you started making detox proteins differently. You upregulated the protein synthesis of antioxidants and glutathione, things like this. You literally built yourself a different body, and here you are thriving, teaching the world everything you've experienced and know, and sharing your world with the rest of the world is exactly what you were supposed to do, I suspect. And that's fascinating to me. You literally built yourself a different body that's supporting a different purpose than you had in your brain before the disease set in. You changed direction at the genetic level, at the microbiome level, at the psycho-spiritual level, you shifted direction.
Wow, that's a really powerful put together there. And I'm just thinking back for something you mentioned. You were studying to be an engineer at some standpoint, right? And I can kind of see that in how you are, because engineers are all about processes, right? Like trying to understand that. And I see that because my son is studying to be an engineer now, and I see that in the way that you're talking or putting these puzzle pieces together. Do you find that that mindset for you of being an engineer, to me, it looks like it's a huge benefit for you in the medical community. So you can come up above and bigger helicopter picture.
Yeah, I think it's why I went into endocrinology. Endocrinology is this coordinating system for the whole body. It's how one organ talks to another organ and coordinates 70 trillion cells to build a single purpose, a single body that would all work in coordination. So I think I was drawn to endocrinology for that kind of engineering mindset of systems, systems processing and all that. But I'm even more crazy than that. I couldn't get away from engineering building at all. So in 2010, as I was leaving academia, I also got my Class A general contractor's license and started a construction company, and then went from there to starting my own engineering company a couple years ago. And so now I have an engineering company that's doing conversion of plastics and farm waste into biodiesel and things like this. So I couldn't get away from the engineering mindset enough to keep myself out of that world, because I'm just so fascinated by the fractal quality of mathematics and systems engineering. So I'm fascinated that my engineering company is basically built a 40-foot mitochondria, and it functions just like a mitochondria would in its sense of fuel usage and fuel production. The mitochondria breaks down glucose and fat, which are totally different looking molecules, into the same molecule, acetyl-CoA. In a single step of an enzyme, it takes fat and sugar and turns it into acyl-CoA, and then one more enzyme, and now it's acetyl-CoA. And so in one step, it turns fat and sugar into the same fuel source. And so we can now do that at the macro level. We can take, you know, rice husks, we can take tires, we can take plastics, we can take marijuana cane, we can take sugar beets, and turn all of that into a single fuel through just one step, which is involves a heat process. And so fascinating that truth is fractal in the universe. If we find that here's a cellular truth, is that glucose and fat turn into a single fuel, we should be able to find out that stars function in the same way in which they transact energy shifts and transmute in this kind of nuclear science fashion the nuclear reactions that are happening inside a star or inside a nuclear reactor here on the planet or whatever it is. And so I'm fascinated that once we start to untangle truths at the atomic physics level or at the biology level, we should immediately be able to blend those things together and bring them together into a single unifying picture of how life happens in the universe.
Yeah, it's kind of like a quantum physics entanglement, right? Like how everything is interconnected with each other.
100%. Yeah, and that interconnectedness, I think, gets more and more obvious at the biology level, but certainly more compellingly at the biophysics level. And so in the end, you know, after, you know, what's now been, I don't know, 25 year journey for me in medical science, it's so fascinating. I mean, I don't usually boil this down to this simple of a thing in a podcast, because it maybe smacks of too simplistic, but in the end, life in the universe boils down to the relationship between light and water, and those two mediums of information transfer, light energy and water structure, is how biology is born, is how biology coordinates itself, how biology can do fractal patterns of life from a single life form like a single cell bacteria all the way to the complexity of a 70 trillion celled human being. All of that's very, very simple in the end as to how that fractal kind of quality or construction happens. And again, it comes down to how much light can you get into a space and how much water energy can you, or how much can you get interaction between that light energy and the water itself. And so that's a very, very distilled version of where I've gotten over the last 25 years. It's very abstract, I think, for your audience at the moment to hear something like that. But the fascinating thing then in my clinic is, you know, whether we're dealing with, you know, a patient one-on-one in the clinic, or we have an 8-week training program that we do online called the Intrinsic Health Series, in both of these environments, our focus is not on disease at all. In fact, one of our big efforts is to help people let go of their belief of a disease, and right. then help them get water and light energy into their bodies. And if you can get those two at a high enough, you know, kind of energetic level, if you can get the vibration of water and you can get connectivity of fiber optic cables for the light to travel between cells, then you get really radical stuff happening and people's lives are changed. And that's much more strong of a statement than saying somebody, improves their autoimmune condition. Their lives are changed at every level. Their relationships change. Their sense of desires change. What they want in their life changes. What kind of job they want changes. What kind of marriage they're willing to have or want to manifest in their lives changes. Their relationship with their children changes. Their relationship to a disease process absolutely changes. All these things because their vibrational energy shifts. And when your vibration changes, your biology has to follow. There's just no option there.
Right.
It is mandated at the fabric of the universe that your body will change when you change your resonance frequency. And so when you change resonance, you change biology. And so the bigger questions for me as a physician again and again come to how do I immediately shift the relationship between a patient and where they're at right now and that system quality of communication and vibration. And it starts ultimately in the human experience, I think, with emotion. If you can start to lever away, if you can start to cut the strings between human emotion and the biology, you immediately upshift the energetic level of vibration of the cells, the water specifically within that cell and its interaction with the light. The two most dominant emotions that I see driving disease are fear and guilt.
Mm.
And it's interesting that medical science has inserted itself into your patient experience primarily by leveraging fear and guilt.
Right. Yeah.
Because there's nobody, we're all energetic beings, meaning that we all have an energetic reaction and an intuitive sense of what we should and shouldn't do. Nobody on earth wakes up in the morning and says, you know what I really would love today is some chemotherapy.
Right.
Never happened. In the history right. of humankind, nobody woke up and said, I'm going to start my day with a good dose of chemotherapy, and then I'm going to see how my workout goes at 10 o'clock. It's just not anywhere in the human psyche or physiology is there a drive for chemotherapy. So how do we build a $400 billion a year chemotherapy industry in the United States? We have to do it out of leveraging an emotion that would overcome the physiologic repulsion away from a toxin.
Wow.
Turns out the chemotherapy that I used to develop is only the tip of the iceberg of the toxicity that we produce in the pharmaceutical industry. All pharmaceutical drugs are toxins. That's why every commercial you've ever heard for a pharmaceutical drug has to be followed by a very long list of horrible things at the end of the commercial that says this will cause impotence, hair loss, death, and everything else in between. It's because they're all functioning as foreign man-made perturbations or distortions of chemical compounds that nature would have provided for us. So we twist these chemical compounds and we then patent them and call them drugs, when in reality they just are naturally toxins. We've created these toxins and then the body is going to react negatively in some form or fashion. So we call those side effects or in more severe cases, adverse reactions or full-on allergic reactions. And so we have this whole kind of cascade of negative effects to these toxins when we put them in our body. And so the only way you're going to get a human species that energetically knows they shouldn't have these things in their body is to start to intercede with the emotion of fear and guilt. And we use both very, very well. In the chemotherapy world, the approach that we use is you have cancer and it's going to kill you. You're going to die of cancer if we don't do something.
Mm.
Well, the reality is we all die, 100%. Well, some people would say we're maybe at 99.999 death rate. Maybe a few people have escaped that death, depending on your worldview and religious beliefs. But overall, humans die. Animals die. Biology goes through a life, death, rebirth process. that cycle is unrelated to cancer or no cancer. And yet we insert this concept of you're going to live except you have cancer, so you're going to die. If that's your paradigm and that's the one we paid for you, now we're going to say there's only three things in the toolbox against cancer. It's radiation, surgery, and chemotherapy.
Right.
If you don't do those, you're going to die. So that's the fear factor. Again and again, I find with my patients, they all say, I'm not even worried about dying. I'll die. That's fine. But I don't want to leave behind my kids. I don't want to leave, behind my loved ones. I don't want to leave them in the lurch. I want to continue to provide for them or be a part of their lives or whatever it is. And that's where the guilt starts to come in. And so when we have patients that are like, I'd rather die than take chemotherapy, then we move in with the guilt thing of, well, what about your kids? What about your grandkids? Don't you want to see them grow up? Why don't we do this? And so we lead with fear, and then we do this little insidious nudge with guilt, and suddenly that patient is lining up for something that they swore all their lives they would never do.
Hmm.
And that's a fascinating way that we use fear and guilt. My world started to really shift in the late 2000s there, 2005 to 2010. My whole world was kind of falling apart, because I was starting to realize really fundamental truths after being a doctor for a number of years. You're a doctor for 8 years in the clinics over and over again, prescribing everything you've been told are the right things, and then watching your patients decline in their health status over time. We can modify the disease markers. I can give you lots of medicine for your diabetes and get your blood sugar lower, but you ultimately die sooner oftentimes because I've accelerated some underlying inflammatory process by tipping the endocrine system with all this exogenous insulin that I'm throwing on. And so that was starting to threaten my worldview of like, I'm only making my patients sicker or accelerating their capacity for health. And then at the same time, realized all this chemotherapy research I was doing, that there was not a single case of cancer in the history of mankind that had been caused by a lack of chemotherapy.
Huh. Right.
That realization, in the same way we could say for autoimmune disease has never occurred because of a lack of steroids or because of a lack of immunosuppressant drugs. And so when you get yourself down to that level of viewpoint, you realize, well, crap, we must just be throwing Band-Aids at a deeper truth here. The pharmaceutical industry must have zero answers for health, because not a single tool that they're throwing at us has anything to do with why the disease actually began.
That's big.
That's
right.
When I started to get my world into nutrition in the late 2000s, started to realize that maybe my vitamin A compounds that I was turning into chemotherapy was actually trying to scream some truth at me, saying that vitamin A in a carrot can actually induce a process that would prevent the cancer from ever happening. And so that was my slippery slope into the world of nutrition, which was my slippery slope into the microbiome and our interaction with this greater ecosystem around us. And in the end, I realized we should really regard the world as no such thing as disease. There's only health or a deficiency of health. Diseases crop up to point us in the right direction as to where we are deficient in health within our bodies. If it's prostate cancer, very specific vulnerabilities had to lead to prostate cancer. Both at the microbiome level, very specific bacteria had to be knocked out and missing. In breast cancer, very specific bacteria, Sphingomonas in that case, has to be missing. And then Methylobacterium tries to move in to help. But if we kill the Methylobacterium, the woman moves into very aggressive and cancer and dies. And so we know that we're creating these deficiencies, very specific deficiencies in health, that will then lead to disease. And so this is the world that I think you are starting to really push out there with your podcast, is we could build a foundation in which disease never has a foothold. And that's what you've done in your life. You've turned your body into this like slippery Teflon-like thing where disease just can't get a foothold. It slips away from you. And we can call that cure, or we can call it remission. But both of those are still disease-centric belief systems. Oh, yeah. You've been cured of cancer or cured of autoimmune disease. No, I wasn't cured of anything. I just became so healthy that the disorder had no place within my physiology anymore. That's the mentality that I think that we need to get ourselves to. So I never tell a patient, look, we're going to do a bunch of stuff and we're going to cure you of this or we're going to put you into remission for that. Instead, I am going to work with you to make you the most robust physiology we possibly can. And then we're going to see what happens. And I'm fascinated that to this day, I never know what's going to happen. And it never happens as my brain would expect it to.
Right.
It's oftentimes the person's knee pain goes away that they've had for 20 years before their cancer changes direction. To that body, the knee pain was more important or a more, you know, significant issue than the cancer was in that body. That fascinates me. Cancer is probably nowhere near as dangerous as we paint it to be, because we don't understand the whole matrix of where inflammation is happening in the body, how it threatens health, how it creates vulnerability. So I'm fascinated by all that. But in the end, it comes again back to emotion, because the patients that I've seen really go on these health and healing journeys begin at letting go of fear and guilt and then insert joy and love in their lives. And so it's interesting that joy and love are not definitions of emotions. Fear and guilt are emotions. Joy and love at their foundation are states of being, not emotions. Emotions last for about 7 seconds in the neurochemistry. The state of joy can last a lifetime. It can be this permanent kind of infrastructure that you build life and your worldview on. And anybody who has traveled the world extensively, especially in the developing world and third world and other environments, it's so often that you'll suddenly realize these are the happiest, most joyful people I've ever known, and they have almost nothing from our industrialized mindset. And so you go to, you know, some of these Polynesian islands, or, you know, Southern Asia, or, you know, all these countries with these high happiness quotients that are now being measured and TED Talks being given on and everything else. You go to these places, and by and large, they have unbelievable amounts of unemployment. I was just told last week that Tahiti has a 94% unemployment rate. That's astounding. 6% of the population of Tahiti is employed. And yet the government of Tahiti gives each family its own real estate. And so they have property. And from that property, they are able to subsistence live. They primarily are fishermen, but they also have fruit trees and some small gardens and things like that. And so they're self-subsisting. So they're unemployed from the Western mind, but they're completely sufficient. Where if you look at the employed, you know, middle America, they have lots of jobs, they have lots of money, but they have no garden. They have absolutely no self-autonomy. Many of them don't own their, most of them don't own their land. Having a mortgage is not owning your land, obviously. Your bank owns that thing.
Right.
So it's a total farce that you own anything. And so you're basically leveraged for your debt potential throughout your life. And the banks and the big investors in the world own everything that you think you're participating in. And ultimately, you're their indentured servant working off debt your whole life so that they can ultimately own your property. And so that is the perfect contrast of what does it mean to be joyful and happy, which is I'm self-sufficient. I can go out every morning and watch the sunrise. I can go swim out in the ocean. I can do some spearfishing, and I can come home to my family. I can eat an amazing fresh-caught meal. I can watch the sunset. I can sit around the campfire and tell some stories, and then I can go to sleep after having sex with my wife. Like, what did we start to miss, that we needed all of this other stuff? We needed the car payments and the house mortgage and all of this stuff, and we lost joy in the pursuit of happiness, perhaps. We were trying to get this stimulation of this happy moment, and we lost that kind of foundational sense of joy, sense of I am cared for by the universe, I am provided by Mother Nature herself, I am part of this Mother Nature. Instead, we're in conflict with Mother Nature. We fight against her from the moment we're conceived. And our medical science comes along and battles all of that back. And now we're lonely, we're isolated, we're in debt, and we wonder why we live a life of fear and guilt and overwhelm.
Wow, that's really powerful. And that hits home because of a few things. I mean, I'm a cancer survivor too. I had it about 15 years ago. That's also part of my journey. And a couple of things that you mentioned there, right? I mean, of what those people were having is they're having connection with other human beings, right? They're with people, not with like phones and things like that, but with people. And they're out in the sun, which is that light factor you were talking about, because now we don't go near the sun. If we are near the sun, we're locked up in SPF 100 to block everything, right? They're in water, right? The energy and structure of the sea, from that one. They're with the earth. They're growing their own food. They're interacting with their own food. They're touching dirt. I mean, all of those factors right there have such powerful healing in it, and we've disconnected from it entirely when I look around, for sure. And it also hits home of why a lot of, when you hit the purpose thing, how many people go through a disease or illness and have come through the other side, and they completely change their life purpose, right? It's like an awakening factor. And it's almost like, man, if you kind of discover your purpose first, right? It may flip that switch for you. I got to tell you, I have such respect for you as a person, because a lot of people, you know, in that medical field may have that realization, but they may not have the strength to change. And you did. I mean, you've done like a 180 with what you're doing. And you ever step back and just look at the journey, where you are now compared to that point, and how many lives you've been able to impact with what you do? It was quite astounding.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I wish I could take credit for all of that. I think we don't have time, I know, for me to tell my whole story as to how I ended up being able to make that decision to leave. It wasn't actually a decision. It was forced on me by... now I would call it the universe and the way in which with life and energy flows and purpose manifests itself. My purpose, you know, ultimately forced me away from academia, and the doors that were slammed shut on me were, you know, something I could have never designed. I resisted change as hard as I could at the time. I was terrified to leave academia, terrified. The scariest night I've had in my professional life was the night before I opened my clinic. I decided to open a clinic in rural Virginia in one of the poorest areas of the country, total food desert, to try to figure out a nutritional process, a nutritional program for reversing chronic disease to the most kind of impoverished and kind of food desert environments out there. But that wasn't what was freaking me out. What was freaking me out was that I was going to be alone and be, you know, a solo practitioner on call 365 days a year, and more importantly, or more frighteningly, 100% responsible for my patients for the first time. When you're in academia, you're super protected from any sense of full responsibility, because you've got this whole matrix of primary care physicians and 17 subspecialists and, you know, hospital administrators and social workers and chaplains. You've got like this whole team, which makes your life much, much easier, but it also dissipates the sense of responsibility. When you're a solo practitioner in rural Virginia and somebody walks into your clinic, it doesn't matter if they have, you know, a massive laceration in their hand or leg that you need to sew up, or they have this, you know, life debilitating migraine syndrome, or they've shown up with cancer and they don't have means to get to, you know, hospital systems, or can't afford the drugs that are being prescribed for them, and they're going bankrupt quickly because they're fifth generation poverty to begin with, and they can't afford $150 of copays a month, and, you know, this tiny stressors for main America become massive, crippling influences on these populations of people. And so I was terrified to go there. And so it took a lot of slamming of doors by the universe to get me to go the path that I took. And so while I appreciate a sense of respect, I have to say it wasn't voluntary. It wasn't something that I perceived that I was going to go pursue this other pathway initially, you know. But in the end, I'm fascinated that, you know, I was being kept in a job that was making me miserable on a lot of levels and very lonely in academia. You get the sense in academia that nobody really has your back, and you're in this constant long rat race.
That's the truth.
You know, getting funding for your research and then getting published and trying to, you know, leverage your way from clinical instructor to assistant associate professor, assistant professor to professor to, you know, you got this huge long 40-year ladder that's laid out in front of you, and you have to kind of, you know, churn away, and there's a lot of backstabbing that happens, and the politics of academia and everything else is so unpleasant. But I was kept there by two emotions, fear and guilt. Hmm. I was terrified to leave because I didn't want to be wholly responsible for my future. I wanted the protection of the big academic center and the 401k and all of that. And guilt that if I left and you know, went into an environment where I had absolutely no economic assurance, when you start your own business, you don't pay yourself for a very long time. And so I ran through my 401k. I cashed in my 401k when I left. It was tiny anyways, but ran through that money very quickly. A woman helped me get a big bank loan for a line of credit, ran through that really quickly. And here I've got two kids that are heading towards high school and college. And, you know, I'm, you know, barely eking out a living. So I actually have to go get two other jobs. I start a construction company, and then I become a associate director for a hospice organization so that I can pay my, you know, tiny little mortgage on the house I'm building. And this, you know, all of these things had to, you know, go down. So my journey was, you know, influenced by, oh, that's, you don't want to go do all that because you won't be able to provide for your family. You won't be able to create, you know, assurance that you can get your kids through college and blah, blah, blah. The faith steps that were taken, I think, felt forced on one side, and I think they were. And on the other hand, there was a level of acceptance that I learned over time. And the two actions that I would encourage each of you who are listening to think about in your own life is, number one, the concept of surrender, and number two, the concept of acceptance. You need to surrender what you believe the pathway is supposed to look like, and you need to accept the path that opens up to you. If you do those two things, your stress levels will drop to zero very quickly. Surrender what you think your pathway should be and accept what your pathway becomes. I was told before I left academia that I would never teach again and I would never be able to do research again if I left and started my own clinic, because I would be so caught up in just patient care and insurance companies, billing, and all of that. That was true for about 3 or 4 years. But then I clawed myself to just enough stability where I started to make some major breakthroughs at the science level, starting to apply all of my pathophysiology knowledge and basic science, biochemistry, and I started to apply that through a new lens of human health. I started to make some amazing discoveries in my own life as well as in my patients' lives, which then ultimately led to the opportunity for me to start my own biotech company. And once I had my own laboratory, I found that I was able to ask radical questions every day, all the time, and surrender the possibility of what would come out of that and accept what we would see out of that. And when you accept that whatever truth comes out of that, you can pivot very quickly. If you stay, you know, you keep some intention, like you have some expectation of where your science or life is going to go, you're 9 times out of 10, or maybe 99% out of 100, going to be disappointed, because you are never going to preconceive where you're supposed to be in a year or two, or what you're supposed to know in a year or two. And so the challenge and opportunity of surrender the journey, surrender your expectations on today, let alone tomorrow, and then accept what that today brings, and then act from that moment tomorrow morning, again, surrendering the expectations of where that new information is going to go, and accept that new information. Now you're in a childlike state. Now you are just a child's mind, which is just witnessing the world around you and fascinated to explore it. It's so freeing. It's so exciting to be alive when you're in that day-to-day reality. But you have to surrender the to-do list. Your to-do list is stressing the hell out of you because you never get through your to-do list in the day, and it gets longer the following day. And so you're never going to get through your to-do list. And so stop doing the to-dos and just do. Wake up, do what's in front of you today, surrendering any expectation on what that's going to produce. Accept what it produces and move on that tomorrow. And so I think if I'm going to boil it down to, how are you all going to accelerate yourself on your healing journey, accelerate yourself into your psycho-spiritual purpose, accelerate yourself into a state of joy, you're going to surrender, and then you're going to accept. And then you wake up tomorrow and do the same thing. and then you're going to do the same thing, and then you're going to do the same thing. Out of that, joy will come. Out of joy, I believe we start to have space in our lives for love. And that is not the emotion of love. It's the being of love. That state of being in love or of love, I think, is really fascinating. It changes the vibration of the experience. There is a vibrational frequency of love, which I think is fascinating that somebody figured that out. And so that vibration of love, that literal wavelength frequency of love, changes biology. And when you're in that state of joy with its frequency and that state of harmonic love and that's there with the joy, you will change the water structure and the light energy between the cells at the biophysics level, which will then change the biology all the way down to the genetics, which proteins you build out of those genes that your mom and dad gave you, which body you build out of that, and you become a different person. And that has to happen because we are at the tipping point, not of your life, but of human history. We've been here for 200,000 years, and now we're looking at maybe 80 years left. 80 years left. And if you talk to the farmers that we work with every day, we're maybe down to 60 years of viable harvests on the planet.
Wow. 60
years of food. If you talk to the bee experts in the world right now, we've moved from perhaps 50 years left of viable bee populations down to 10 years left of viable bee populations.
10? Whoa.
Whether we're at 10 years, 80 years, it doesn't matter. This is a blink in time compared to the 200,000 years that Homo sapiens have been here.
Yeah. Well, first of all,
we're at the tipping point, and you all showed up right now, which means you have great purpose in this tipping point. If you have great purpose and you're not in it, diseases are going to happen in your life. Stress is going to happen in your life because you're going the wrong direction. This comes down to simple physics again. Wrong direction in a stream. When you're upstream, you create an enormous amount of friction between you and the current of the river you're in. If you surrender and stop flailing around and float, you will travel down the river at the same rate of the current, and you will be in flow, and there will be zero resistance, zero friction between you and the flow of the river. You are in a life that should be in flow, meaning there should be no resistance or friction between you and tomorrow. If you go to sleep exhausted, feeling stressed and pulling apart at the fibers of your body from the amount of friction you're creating, it is likely because your purpose is not aligned with the flow of the universe. Your purpose is maybe to get job promotions or make more money or do this or that. That is not in the direction of flow most of the time. And so if you feel stress in your life, stop that, surrender. It begins with just 5 minutes of quietness. If you can stop for 5 minutes and just make your mind empty, picture yourself in that water where you're just like going to surrender to the current finally and stop trying to swim and flail around, float down the river for a moment. That's where your space is going to start. And that can expand into your whole life so that life becomes a meditative, floating, in-flow process where you get to surrender your expectations on the day, in your relationships, in your job, in your productivity. And what you will manifest is your role in the flow of life in this world around us. And that's what I look forward to seeing unfold in your life, because that will change the course of humanity, because I believe we have been against our purpose. We've been swimming upstream of Mother Nature for thousands of years. We need to turn around, float down the river of life and Mother Nature. We need to join her current up towards life and regeneration, and do that in our farming practices, in our medical practices, in our lifestyles and practices. We need to adopt a flow state with Mother Nature and her direction of life.
That was absolutely beautiful, Doc. That was fantastic. First of all, thank you very much for sharing that perspective of yourself and hell with the world in general. You know, there were some really profound statements in there that I can attest to personally, of just surrendering to where my life is going and accepting it is. And it's kind of a testament when you were revealing your story of how, you know, it's through the greatest suffering or pain that we learn our biggest lessons. Nobody wants to go into it. usually willingly, though, right? But if you're supposed to be there, the universe is going to find a way to send you in that direction, whether you want to or not.
That's exactly right. I mean, it's like gravity. It's a law of nature that you will be pushed towards your purpose. It's a law of nature that you are going to ultimately have to align with this flow of life. And unfortunately, we often don't do that until our moment of death. But I have seen it over and over again as a hospice doctor, thousands of times I've seen patients in the last minutes, hours, and days of their life suddenly finally align to a state of realization that they are unified with this greater life force and that they're going to flow back into it at this moment that we call death. But it's just this rebirth, transformation, energetic shift that happens when you're animating a biologic system and you shift into light energy and let go of that biologic aspect for a moment. You just become vibrational light energy. And some people would call that a soul. Some people would call it, spirit, whatever it is. But at the biophysics level, we can literally image this. We have a camera and clinic designed by Konstantin Korotkov in Russia. And it just images the human energetic field. And you can see this at the point of death start to dissipate over a three-day period where the light energy dissipates from the body in a very predictable fashion. And so that light energy is going back out into the space around. And there is no destruction of energy. That's one of the fundamentals of astrophysics, atomic physics. You cannot destroy energy. It can only change form. And so you're shifting from a biologic state to an energetic state. Interestingly, in the hospital setting, we get the opportunity to often resuscitate or occasionally resuscitate people from that kind of transcendent energetic shift back into the biologic state. And the stories that they bring back, even if it's only been 3 or 13 minutes of death away from the biology, where biology kind of starts to cease, they come back with experiences of what's happening on the other side of that biologic veil. They went on an energetic journey, a unification with the energy field of the universe, and they bring back phenomenally interesting stories of what they experienced in those few minutes, and their lives are forever changed. And many of them will go on to live, either short or very long lives. One of my closest colleagues is in her 80s. She's wonderful. She's one of the foremost experts in bee medicine, using the honeybee toxin as a medicinal. And she died of a heart attack when she was 67 and was dead for 23 minutes. And the journey she took in those 23 minutes redefined the next 30 years of her life. And so she's just in this incredible state of function. She's writing books. She runs her own training center of human health and healing. She's just a machine of productivity and human love and care in well into her 80s here. And so that's kind of, on the one end. The other end is, patients that will come back for a few minutes just to report what they experienced and then have a conversation with a loved one that heals, decades of broken relationship and estrangement and all that. And they heal that moment and then they move back and die, as we would call it on this side, and they transition back. And so whether it's a few minutes to decades, I see that energetic space informing the life purpose. My hope is that we can get there as a health and healing community to start to support human beings to make this transition towards an awareness and a connection to that flow state of energy and that sense of purpose, that sense of connectivity before that moment of death, so that we can live out purpose in much larger portions of our biologic lifespans and therefore change human history dramatically. We will build different products, technologies, and governments when we get in that flow state.
Yeah, and goodness knows we need it in the world today. And, I got to tell you, from just listening to you, I picked up on something. And, I mentioned before about light and water, right? And here I am thinking just, outside light and then water. But the way you had mentioned it was pretty powerful for me, is that changing that state of joy, or I have a lot of people that don't have any self-love, right, for themselves. And if you can change that thought process of even just acceptance of who you are and the joy of who you are, and then you said that's actually what starts to change your light in your water. I mean, that's really profound, right? Of just, it starts from inside. right? So when you work with your clients, that's the things that you're starting to teach them, right?
That's why we call it the Intrinsic Health Series. We have intrinsic health.
Now I put it together.
So that's my, in the end, that's my realization is there is no physician, scientists, you know, shaman, drug, supplement out there that's going to add to your capacity for health. It can certainly, you know, support, but it's not the source of life at any moment. Source of life, source of purpose, source of light, and ultimately source of vibration of the water within your body is all coming from within you. And it's ultimately coming out of this interesting thing called self-identity, right? It's so bizarre that you have never woken up once in your life thinking you were Zach or that you were anybody else. You wake up every morning with this sense of self-identity that transcends any roles you play in life. It's transcendent of your identity as a son or a daughter or a brother or a sister or a father or an aunt or an uncle or a grandparent or an employee or a boss or a general or a, you know, foot soldier. Doesn't matter, you know, any of these roles. They don't change your innate sense of self-identity. Your self-identity is transcendent. What is that self-identity? It's literally a vibration that's unique to you. And in the biophysics world, it looks like the DNA functions as an antenna to absorb universal energy and vibrate or pull out a single vibration within that energy that would be your vibration. Your vibration being slightly different than my vibration, but different enough such that we never mix self-identities. Mm. And so I'm fascinated that in the end, self-identity is innate to the human being, and from that is connectivity, and with connectivity from that self-identity, we get resonance and cooperative relationship between 70 trillion human cells, which are cooperating with, you know, somewhere around 1.5 quadrillion bacteria and fungi, and probably far more than that in the virus world and all that. And so we've got this massive universe that cycles in and around and within us as a microbiome that's communicating with this self-identity and supporting ultimately that self-identity. And so in the end, it's way beyond that little adage of you are what you eat. You simply are. You are. And you are enough. You don't have to be anything. You don't have to play any of those roles forementioned to be worthwhile. The fact that you were born with a self-identity that would then drive a biology as complex as yours would suggest that you are enough. Just that self-identity alone that you woke up with is why you're here. You don't have to make a paycheck. You don't have to have a mortgage. You don't have to have a fancy house. You don't have to have anything. None of that can possibly improve upon the awesome reality that you are a self-identity that is vibrating in space and time right now to participate in what must be the most exciting moment of this human experiment that's run for 200,000 years. We are at the tipping point. You're here to participate in. You're here to empower this moment. And the more you can let go of all of those other energies, all those low energy states of debt and stress and broken relationships or roles in your life, let go of all of that for a minute. Surrender all of your belief of failures and disappointments. Surrender all that and say, no, there was no failure. I was simply striving upstream. I was creating so much friction in my life because I was going in a direction that the society had told me to go in, not that Mother Nature had told me to go in. So let go of all of those, float downstream and become who you are, and let's see what we turn into as a human species.
That's a perfect way to end the show, Doc. Absolutely great. You know, I mean, I was going to try to venture into your Restore product and the Farmer's Footprint, but it just seems like this is the universe telling me that that's a good way to end it. Cause guys, you can, trust me, I always joke, Doc, cause I'm a product of the '80s. I always say you can rewind the podcast all the time. You guys should replay this one a lot and really listen to it because there's so many life lessons in here from Doc. And of course you can go to his social media stuff and I'm going to post up and look at his Farmer's Footprint work and his product Restore, which I used and made a profound impact on helping to heal my gut for sure. But the stuff that he was talking about today, you really don't hear that much in the world today. And the world really, really needs it. And like I said, it starts with you. So, Doc, thank you so much for sharing of yourself and your journey with me and my listeners today. It was even beyond my expectations. I appreciate it.
I appreciate your time and all of you listening. Thank you for your attention. And I really enjoy thinking about your trajectory as you surrender and accept and live into that joy and love in your life.
Thank you. Yeah, would you, for people that are listening, I know I'm going to put up a link for anything, but is there any particular place that you'd like the listeners to maybe venture first in discovering more of your work, maybe even the program that you mentioned before?
Zach Bush, MD, you can get to just about everything else I'm doing, ZachBushMD.com. That's kind of my educational site. That's kind of the portal into the rest of my world and the rest of my frontal lobe, maybe, and explore everything about it at any given time. You can follow me on Instagram, ZachBushMD there, and we can continue this discussion and conversation, because I don't believe there's a didactic experience here. I think there's a fellowship unfolding, and I would ask that you guys continue to participate in that. And so reach out through the social media platforms or otherwise. I have so many exciting things to share with you in the years to come. We're rolling out extremely exciting technologies in the area of reinventing the internet, reinventing currency and what it means to reinvent money itself, and how we're going to communicate through these things, energy, how we're going to produce energy and kind of decentralize the oil and gas industry, how the intrinsic health can kind of unwire our codependence on the pharmaceutical world. And so my passion is to really disrupt these big societal structures that have forced us into these consumptive pathways of behavior to a regenerative pathway. So Farmers Footprint is our nonprofit that you can dive into. Farmersfootprint.us is the website there, and see what we're doing on the nonprofit side to train chemical farmers to be regenerative organic farmers, and how to live a much more abundant life and surrender to Mother Nature and let her participate again in the production of our food system, rather than fight against her at every level. So a lot to be welcomed into there, but Zach Bush MD will open up a lot of those pathways for you.
Great. And I got to tell you, I had to thank you for getting me back into gardening. Like, I love to do it to get my own food, but man, it's so therapeutic. Because when I'm gardening, I'm just gardening. I'm not thinking about anything else.
That's my if I had any influence on that, that's my biggest accomplishment in your life. So go out and garden. So enjoy that and get your hands dirty. Taste a tomato off the vine. That's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, and I hope to meet you in person one day for sure. I'm actually from Virginia. I grew up in Martinsville, Virginia.
Kidding.
Yeah. The only half-miler NASCAR Speedway racetrack.
That's the drag race capital of the state here, right? Yeah. Well, I was big into racing. Cars were my first passion, so I started restoring classic cars when I was about 14 and did that for a couple decades, really. I love classic cars and racing and all that. So I've been down to Martinville Speedway and all that. That's great. That's a fun tradition that came out of there.
Yeah, sure does. And I'll get the accent back, too.
There you go. Virginia draw will come right back.
It sure does. Yeah, I'm going to just do a quick, if you don't mind, like snap photo up here. So I'm going to share it on the internet there. So I'll do a quick pick. There you go. Came out perfect. Awesome. Great. Already saved that up there. Great. So again, thank you. I know you stayed on a little bit longer. I really appreciate it. And I know my assistant, Louisa, just loves you to death. So, she's excited to get you on the show. Thanks again for your time, Doc. We'll talk soon.
I appreciate the invite. Thanks for having me on. Take care.
Bye.